Hello there, friends, and welcome to Down the Yellow Brick Pod, your enchanted passport and sometimes twister over the rainbow and down a yellow brick rabbit hole as we pull back the curtain on American culture's most visited fairyland. We are your co-hosts, Tara
and MK, your good trouble witches of the concrete jungle, here to preserve the rustic emeralds of yesteryear and reimagine an Oz for today and future generations. This season, our third, we return to BOM and the turn of the 20th century, finishing up our remaining 13 books in the original Oz series, penned by first royal historian of Oz himself, L. Frank Baum, and published between 1904 and 1920 posthumously.
And then we return to Oz, taking up residency in Disney's dark, disturbing, and kind of delayed fantasy sequel of the Kinder Trauma Age, scarring viewers since 1985, a near 50 years after the MGM release. Wheelers and shock therapy and screaming heads. Oh my, we are in for a wild ride. Buckle up, babies.
Off the pod, feel free to visit our Insta at Down the Yellow Brick Pod for an accompanying Technicolor scrapbook, as well as our Patreon Pod Squad, where we continue the escapism and entertainment with bonus content from Tiny Oz concerts, think coffee shop style covers and mashups of Aussie tunes, our Yellow Brick vlogs, exclusive episodes, monthly parties with occasional special guest drop-ins and giveaways, and more behind-the-scenes shenanigans. As a community-funded podcast, our Patreons are truly our backbone, our people. So consider joining our Pod Squad today. It would make our day.
Now, may the world of Oz continue to be a bewitching escape in bewildering years. Nostalgic and nuanced, and a magical refuge where two gals in New York City can cross yellow brick roads with wonders like you. Hey, Em, to Oz?
To Oz! Cassine Gaines is an author, director, educator, and popular culture historian. His work has received praise from media outlets around the world, including The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, The Hollywood Reporter, and Esquire. His muscular reporting has been celebrated by several New York Times bestselling authors, including Michael Davis and Brian J. Jones, who have found his work to be deeply researched and engagingly written. His latest book, Footnotes, The Black Artists Who Rewrote the Rules of the Great White Way, was published in May 2021 by Source Books. Beyond his books, he has been published at Vanity Fair, IO9, and New York Magazine, and has written original features for Rolling Stone, The AV Club, and Decider. He has also worked as a consultant and ghostwriter on several narrative nonfiction projects. He holds a master's degree from Rutgers University in American Studies, where he focused on racial representations in popular culture, and, in addition to writing, is co-artistic director of a nonprofit theater company he co-founded in 2005, and a high school English teacher in New Jersey, where he has taught for 14 years.
Listeners, MK, Cassine, hey, what's up?
Hello, hello, hello.
Woo! Here we are at the end of Return to Oz, which I can't believe we got here. This has been the best accompaniment to this summer to get to relive this 80s nostalgic film. And also, I think mine the gems out of it that get discarded, I think, with this film. Mm-hmm. So it's been an absolute pleasure and treasure of a time. And I'm so grateful to have both of you here to conclude our time and Return to Oz. So let's start off with an interpretation check-in, because this film, everyone has an opinion on it. Some people completely write it off. Some people consider it to be the best Oz film, which is also interesting. So it definitely runs the gamut. And I think it really matters when you saw this film. So Cassine, you have to presence for us when you saw this film for the first time, yes. If it's had like a nostalgic relationship with yourself. I think that really plays a big part. I feel like if you watch, like my husband was like, it's not a good movie. He didn't grow up with it. You know, like he didn't grow up with it. And I'm like, I think if, because he didn't have it and he's not like a crazy Oz person, I think that adds to the fact that he can't really connect to this film. Mm-hmm. So it's just so interesting. Like everyone has their own relationship with it. But mm-hmm. just want to check in with like how you're interpreting this film. Like, is Oz real in this film? What are your thoughts on what the message of the film is? Let's start there. And then I have a little soulful question for us.
But sure.
First, interpretation. Cassine, start us off.
So I first saw the film when I was a kid, and yes. I've seen it, I think maybe on HBO or something like that. Like, I feel like it was just on TV a lot. And I probably saw it maybe a dozen or so times as a kid, but then haven't seen it for probably at least 25 years since. So when I got the invite to be on, I was like, oh, this is exciting, because at least it gives me a reason to go back and rewatch it. And I'll be honest, in the years in between, I've read a lot about the film, and I've sort of wondered, when I go back to it, is it going to be like I remember it being? I couldn't, you know, special effects, just for example, look mm-hmm. different when you are a child versus yes. when you're an adult.
Yes.
I know a lot more now about how, you know, those things work, and I didn't know if I would appreciate or not. So it was interesting to kind of go back to it. But in terms of whether or not I think Oz is real, I mean, first of all, I just think Oz is real, period. I mean, just in any, you know, that's just not even a question for me.
Not a question.
But I actually think it's more interesting to view the film as like a history. I know that's like a little bit weird, but like not okay. even as okay. a story, but just like a legit history of this period in Oz and also mm-hmm. America. And I say that because they really ground the film in fall 1899. Like, it's yes, really, it's really like centered in a way that the 1939 film isn't. And even The Wiz isn't as specific about where mm-hmm. it's set. And I think that because the filmmakers are making such an effort to do that, I think as viewers, we should just sort of view it as just like a straight history text and take it really seriously.
I love that. This is an account of 1899.
Right, yeah, right, right. So by that metric, you actually can't question the accuracy of anything in this film. It is just
it's fact. A history textbook, yeah.
That's it.
Wow. I'm here for that.
I'm liking this interpretation.
Yeah, I don't think we've heard
now
that.
Now I'm like, wait, what do I think now? I Ooh. Feel like I'm going to keep changing my mind on this film. Em, do you want to go or do you want me to go?
So here for that. I never would have really thought of that, of like, this is just what it is, straightforward. But I'm so with you, Cassine. I think it's so real. I think Oz actually is real and that she actually went. To me, it makes sense. Like, with all of you.
Oh, I'm on my own. I think I'm on my own.
Oh.
I think it's going. With like all of the electrical currents, the fact that I think this could happen. This
Will?
Really could happen. Yeah.
Will?
And then hearing it, we've talked a lot about Stranger Things throughout this section of the season. I think there's definitely some crossover happening there, even though I got confused
Oz
about 1899 versus the 80s. I was like, these are different time periods. But the fact that at the end, she still is seeing Ozma in the mirror. To me, it's like, well, that's real.
But is she? Is she?
I think her? She is. I 100%
I'm like the devil as advocate.
I know, you're on devil on my shoulder. But you also asked an interesting question of like, what is maybe the moral of the story?
The
message, which I'm not entirely sure. But I did find this really interesting article. I haven't read the whole thing, but it was published in June of this year, which is pretty cool, by Lauren Perry. And it's called Why Return to Oz is the Most Faithful Wizard of Oz Adaptation on Movie.
I think that's correct.
MovieWeb.com. And I wanted to read one quote. She says, "The exploration of fear through such things as the unfamiliar, the uncanny, and the outright terrifying is part of what is so faithful to the novels. Many of the characters and events from the movie come straight from the novels, and many later books would even get darker and more adult. The books don't let up on the horror, and the movie honors that, giving children a chance to confront these fears and find a satisfying resolution to them at the end." I feel like I connected with that because I didn't see this as a kid. I would have been way too terrified. And maybe I should have, because I think it does sort of offer Dorothy autonomy. And even though she might be frightened, like, she faces these fears. And then there is that beautiful hug at the end, spoiler alert, where it's like, time has passed. But I think she even looks a little bit older by the end of the film, which, you know, she was a kid as an actor, so that makes sense. So I think there's just a little bit running through the entire Oz canon of facing your fears as a really young kid.
Yeah, I think the I didn't address the sort of like message, and I didn't really have anything because I didn't have an answer either. But as you're saying this, I'm sort of thinking like, there's something about the limitations of all of these characters and how they push through the limitations. Like, even when you think about, you know, like, no one's able to fully function in this film. You know, Jack needs to be put together. TikTok is always like being unwound. Like, you know, like the head can't fly. You know, like, there are all these things that like can't fully function. And yet somehow they're able to collectively be stronger than like the sum of their parts. And I think maybe there's something to that, that like, you know, as long as you sort of find your allies, your friends, and kind of draw on that collective strength, you can succeed. And I think that that's sort of maybe a part of the message of this.
Oh, love that. I love all of this. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now you're going to destroy it. You're going to burn it all down.
Burn it down. Burn it down like Dr. Joanne Worley's insane asylum. We call him Joanne Worley based off of the actress because we love her. Okay. So how I'm interpreting this film is, this is an alternate Oz universe for me. Like, it's, and I love this alternate Oz universe. It's almost like a Doctor Strange that exists in another plane for me. I think that Dorothy and Ozma are the same person in this film. Ooh. I am going to go with that. Based off of the Ruby Slippers granting this wish of her being in two places at once, it becomes immediately like, oh, there's Ozma. And like, no one else justifies that Ozma exists, and she doesn't even really, when she asks, like, or when she says, Frusa Balk, Dorothy says, like, I thought you had drowned, when she sees her for the first time, she doesn't even really address that. The Ozma character, like, it's so interesting, like, nothing is really like, Ozma's really truly, like, they could be the same person, and we've had a long conversation with this. I don't think that's the film's intention. I really don't, because there are cut scenes, which we will talk about. But that's how, what is left of the film, how I see it, that she leaves a piece of her in Oz. And then when she looks in the mirror, she's really seeing herself, but she is seeing herself as Ozma at the end. And for me, how that translates to message is that I think it's an L. Frank Baum thing, actually. Okay, stay with me, people. Here we go. I'm trying to piece this together as we go. L. Frank Baum had this insanely wild imagination that, like, was ahead of its time, and, like, it didn't always make sense to the times he was living in, which was, he was on a hard scrabble lifestyle out in South Dakota for some time. He couldn't just be dreaming all the time. He had to make money. He had to support his family. And I think, like, what we're seeing here is this young girl who has this imagination that doesn't make sense to the hard scrabble time that she's in, because it distracts her from her daily chores, the life that, like, you know, just daily survival things that she needs to be paying attention to. And it was distracting so much at the top of the film that she couldn't function in society the way that she needed to. And now at the end of the film, she's found a way to preserve her imagination, but also still not ignore reality and, like, the life she's living at this time. I don't know if I'm quite piecing it together exactly there. I think it'll come as we go, but that's, like, how I see this film, is, like, you can have both. And maybe you don't trust everyone with your imagination. Maybe it's too much for certain people, because it's not going to be for Aunt Em and Uncle Henry. They don't get it. But Toto gets it. Toto can see in the mirror too. So it's really, I don't know where I'm going with this. This is just, like, my interpretive, like, how it's going through me, and probably where I'm at right now. I also have to present, I binged yesterday A League of Their Own. And holy cow. I
heard it so
don't think
good.
I felt it's so good. I like need everyone to just pause us and go start.
Turn us off.
It is. I mean, the Oz of it is insane. There's so much Oz in it, which is just beautiful. But beyond that, like I don't even like watching that with ending this film has just put me in an emotional place of like what we have to do to keep our dreams alive. And like how oftentimes that is like, you are scratching against the grains of reality. Like everyone saying no, the world saying no, or whatever, you know? And yeah, I guess that's just where I'm living right now too, is like me and my human, like, do I keep pursuing my dreams of what all the things I want to do? Or do I do something that's a little bit easier or safer? Like, it's like all those kinds of questions come up. So that's where I'm at with all of that. I hope that made sense.
That's
beautiful.
Can I
ask you, in like, does that carry through in this interpretation, does that carry through to the scene in the hospital? Like, is the Ozma doppelganger, you know, like the Kansas version, is she real? Because as I'm trying to replay in my mind, I feel like there's almost a way where you could interpret it almost like Fight Club, right? Where like she's like that character is never really there.
That's what I did when we started.
Okay.
Like I was like, but we will talk about. There's deleted scenes that would contradict me, but they didn't make it into the film.
Right? Well, then they don't count.
They don't count.
They're not canon. But, they're not in the history book.
I was like, Nurse Mombi, our Nurse Wilson at the top, does never addresses the blonde girl.
Never addresses her. See, I was trying to remember. That's fascinating. Not even when they're like running to the river. No.
Yeah, she never specifically.
Oh, that's so. Now, see, you're literally going to make me. Now, everyone, pause again. Now that you've watched all of A League of Their Own, can you come back? Pause again and go watch Return to Oz again. Because I'm literally going to go watch it again. And because this is fascinating to me. This is such an interesting take.
I think because that all got cut, and we'll talk about what got cut, because there was a whole thing that was supposed to be in this scene that would have completely destroyed what I just said. But I really think that Ozma does not. It's her. She's Ozma. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's my Anne of Green Gables in me, because Anne of Green Gables had a friend in the mirror that she would talk to and like really brought her comfort. Like that's something I think, I don't know, like I'm like Victorian era kids talk to themselves in the mirror and they imagine themselves as princesses of faraway fantastical lands. So that's just where my brain goes. And I find comfort in that because I think I'm a little bit of that girl. Like, I have gone to different places just within my head that I have seen, but I can't really explain it to someone else. They'll never truly get it, you know?
Well, that's what's interesting about Return to Oz is at the end, she doesn't tell anybody about even what she's been through or what she's seen. I mean, she kind of starts to with, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but she's kind of like, Aunt Em, come look at Ozma in the mirror. And
no.
And decides not to. You know, I know the little
like she's creepy. Like, don't, you know, she's like, don't do that again.
Don't do that again. We've learned like, our lesson.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Is maybe no matter how you interpret it, whether it's real or not, because say you did think it was real or it really happened, it's still so sacred that she keeps it to herself. And it's almost like it's so real to her that she doesn't even need to explain it to anyone else.
It's a which I kind of like. To me. It's a real.
Can you imagine?
Just a little coffee coat it home from the house. Okay, well, and with that beautiful segue, here's a little soulful question. I think we've asked this question before, Em, because it always comes up in like when we're following the Oz journey, the theme of like hard goodbyes, because like Dorothy clearly does not want to say goodbye. And also Ozma's like, bye, girl. Click.
I know she is going.
I was like, no time to waste.
Get ready.
She said, this film is just racking up the minutes. We got to get kids home. It is so funny to me. But anyways, we know this is a hard goodbye. right? Yeah. Like, this is not, like, she's does not want to leave. So anything that you would like to presence that was a hard goodbye for you, it could be recent, it could be your biggest one to date, whatever you'd like to share. I actually have no clue how I'm going to answer this. It could be like knowing like you're not going to see a family or friend for a very long time. Because, you know, I'll start us off. I actually felt that after Em and I got to go to the Judy Garland's 100th birthday gala out in LA, and we got to be with like our Oz people, which is, that's rare. Like, we all live scattered across the United States and some of us even outside of the United States. And I knew when we were there, I was like, freeze time. Cause like, this only happens like every so often. This was like the first true thing too, that we had with this group of people together. And just knowing that we were going to, you know, after this weekend of being super close, we're going to go back to our regular lives, like, was like definitely sad. And like, I wish I lived closer to a lot of the people we saw. It just felt like easy family. So yeah, I'll start with that. Just like when you have these moments where you get to come together. I'm also going to be so honest. I voice memoed Em earlier today crying after watching League of Their Own, because I was like, I miss being on a team. I literally was just like, I miss it. I miss being on a team so much. Mm-hmm. I was crying, guys. I've been going through it.
No, this it's move, real.
All of these things that have happened. Listeners, I also had a hit and run that happened. There's just been so many things in my life. And then I just am like, I want to be on a team. Like all that stuff. I know I'm on teams. I know that is the case. But sometimes you just need that uniform. You just need to feel that uniform and all those things, you know, right? So yeah, like I think that's what the hard goodbyes are always when I'm saying goodbye to some people who feel like a team.
Right. And you know, like we're not all going to be in this exact same space again.
Ever again.
Ever.
That's what I say at the end of every circle that I lead for the Circlehood. I'm always like, this group of human beings will never exist in this way ever again. Like it's, we don't really pause, I think, a lot for that. Cause it is like, oh my gosh, that's an emotion that I don't really know if I want to deal with. Like I want to run from that maybe sometimes too, but it is just a cool acknowledgement to be like, wow, okay, cool. So this is a precious, sacred moment. Yeah. Okay, hard goodbyes. It's hard to say goodbye, my love.
Ooh, I love it. I love it.
It hops.
So hard.
Yes.
And I can sing.
That's right. We're just going to do it.
We're just singing.
So I would, you know, it's so funny. I mean, you know, I really have a hard time. I almost think all my goodbyes are hard goodbyes, to be honest with you. And this is actually like a life thing that I feel like I have always been working on because I've always had this sort of ability, I think, to take an experience and distill the positive attributes, you know, out of that experience, even ones that are, you know, not great. I'm pretty good at finding a silver lining, you know? And so, but because of that, it's sometimes hard to say goodbye to even not great experiences. Cause I'm kind of like, well, but even the silver lining I'm saying goodbye to, you know? So, that's always sort of a weird, hard thing for me. And I think, I don't know. It's funny because I'm trying to think of like a not hard goodbye instead of a hard one. That's like seeing friends, seeing family. I mean, yesterday I just had a book event, and it was my third one since the pandemic started that was in person, but the other two were like considerably smaller. This was like a bigger scale thing and it went very, very well. And it was so nice and not like overwhelming. And then like, I almost didn't even want to go to sleep. You know, I just almost didn't want the day to end, you know, it was like a really, really nice experience. And I feel like I just live my life like in that energy, in that space, you know? So yeah, it's hard. I'm trying to think, I guess a specific memory though, I can really think of is I used to spend summers in Virginia visiting family. And I, like out of a movie, as we would be like driving away from like their like little like country home, like down the road, like you would see the family that we were visiting waving and waving, and they would just get smaller and smaller and smaller. And like, you would never see the end of their wave. It would just be like this wave as you were looking out the car. And like, I remember that being like the conclusion of that volume of my summer, like every year for like, you know, 7 or 8 years, like literally the long goodbye. Yeah.
Oh, my dad.
Oh, my heart.
My dad used to do something when I would get on like a New Jersey Transit train to go back either to Philadelphia or to New York City. He would go outside my window and just like, as I'm like getting into my like, you know, my little seat, he'd just stand there like Tony Tag. My dad is very funny because he just is like, he's like a subtle hilarious guy. He just stands outside the window. And then as soon as the train starts to move, he would start to like,
oh my god.
Try to like, Jesus, so cute. He's always done it. He still does it. It's really, really sweet. So you just gave me that memory. That's so, I love that. The families that like,
family goodbye,
have the ritual, the ritual and the goodbye.
Yeah.
It's so sweet.
Oh, by the way, so subtle beautiful. Hilarious is my favorite kind of hilarious.
I really good.
You would love
he's Tony. Really, yeah, he's a good guy. He's a good one.
You'll keep him around. You'll keep him.
I'll keep him. He's a good one.
You made the cut.
I didn't even say the fact that like we said goodbye to our apartment like this week, like officially the keys are gone. Like,
oh, it was this week?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It was Friday.
It was like Friday. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, I watched my husband sob. He broke down, completely broke down. It's been his apartment since he was 22. Like, that's a lot.
That's wild. That is a lot.
That apartment saw him become a New Yorker, you know? Go from this sweet Arizona desert boy to like, you know, like hard ass New Yorker.
Friendly words now. Just walking down the street.
Yeah. Yes.
Jaded.
Aren't we all?
No, I mean, we all are. Just a little bit. If you live in the city, you got to be a little jaded. You got to be.
It's totally
like, the jade that like takes over is totally like a survival instinct, I think.
Oh, yeah.
For the city. It's just like totally does. But I didn't even presence that we said officially goodbye to 2R.
No, I was thinking of that. I mean, oh, I feel like it's just been a week. It's been something in the air. I personally had COVID last week. And so it got me. So I found myself with a lot of time to just reflect. And I just feel like all of these memories were coming up and a lot of journaling was happening because I had nothing else to do. And last night I was kind of processing and journaling. And speaking of crying, I wrote something in my journal that I reread a sentence and I just started crying. And the sentence was,
that's,
it's
good,
okay.
That's a good journal. That's a
I
good
know.
Journal.
I know. That's I'm a pretty
good
amazing.
Sesh, girl.
Self-therapy.
Yes.
The sentence was, it's okay to let go, Em. It's okay to let go.
It's because you said your name. That's always what gets me.
Because I said my name.
Like, yeah, when you put your name in it, it's
talking
like
to yourself.
Oh God. Okay, I'm talking to
myself. It
was
something I really needed to hear, and I think I'm with you, Cassine. Like, I even if it's a kind of negative experience or something that I wouldn't go back to, it's still like change is hard. Change is really hard to let go
change
of, and I've just been thinking like, I feel like we say a million goodbyes a day. Of, you know, yesterday I had coffee with a friend who was my first college friend, the very first person I actually like met. We're both from very different parts of the country, but we became best friends throughout college. And then she now lives in England. So I haven't seen her for many years. And we were just sort of reminiscing and we were like, how did we even move to New York at age 18? And I was just recounting the memory of my parents dropping me off at the dorm and then the last day when they got into the cab and we were just like, bye, you're going back to California. Like saying goodbye in those really intense moments, big and small. So I don't know. It's just interesting because it's like you say goodbye, but I still have that vivid memory in my head. So have you really said goodbye? I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I think more often than not, life is change and life is saying goodbye, whether that's to like who I am today or who I was last week or goodbye to having that experience of having COVID last week. Like there's always something
right,
that we're moving on from. And I think I personally would like to be able to let go with a little more grace instead of being like, no, I can be a little bit more like grabbing on.
I think that's human nature, though. That's yeah. like we grab.
Yeah.
But it's healthier to release.
Right, right. I'd like to practice getting better. Like when Dorothy's like, it's so bright and you can kind of see the transition happening. Like I feel anxiety like, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. But I don't know if we're ever ready, you know. So
right, that's it. You nailed it. You said something. You said we are always moving on from something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we're moving on from this movie after today. Like, this is a sacred experience, you know? Yeah. Our first piece through of this film.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cherishing the moment, friends.
Thanks for taking us there.
Okay. Well, we'll see you in this final scene of Return to Oz.
Welcome back, listeners. We hope you're in your feels. Well, at this point, you should have journaled. You should have watched League of Their Own. You should have gone back and watched this entire film. So it's been days now that you've been in this episode. But we are about to dive into our bullet points. Our last one for Return to Oz.
Here we go. Final scene. Magically dumped in the populous poppy fields. In the Ruby Slipper's haste, as the Emerald City's emeralds restore on the horizon, Dorothy is quick to notice her loyal copper friend is MIA. But leave it to Belina to notice a stowaway ornament, both copper and emerald, dangling on the Gump's antler that, thank goodness, is Oz. TikTok, which now with everyone intact means it's time to party back in the EC, where invitations went out faster than Ozma's birthday parties in the books. And play, where's Waldo trying to freeze frame later bomb book favorites like it's an Easter egg parade as we soon gather around the throne. Even the Wheelers will behave. The Scarecrow holding his crown and everyone chanting at Dorothy, Queen of Oz, Queen of Oz. But Dorothy says she's got to go home. Sorry, not sorry. Wishing she could somehow be in two places at once. Which the Ruby Slipper's genie lamp obey? That's how they work now. Revealing Dorothy's reflection in the mirror to be the mysterious blonde girl from the sanitarium who... I thought you drowned, is looking fresh in a regal gown where the category is Emerald Princess and headdress, stepping through the mirror to be by Dorothy's side, where it is soon revealed that she is Ozma, daughter of King Pastoria pre-wizard times, which I'm noting this, friends. We need to talk about the wizard. We need to talk about the wizard. Mm-hmm. Make me circle back to it because he's MIA. And also Glinda's very MIA, but the wizard is responsible for the reason why there's stolen emeralds in the Emerald City, and he doesn't pay for it. Okay, just putting that in there. Okay, so daughter of King Pastoria pre-wizard times, Jack Pumpkinhead's mom, she's the one who made him, and rightful ruler of Oz, held captive for many years by Zombie Mombi, that's what I'm calling her now, who remains in her cage, stripped of her magic and a miserable creature indeed. Ozma retaking the emerald and gold throne, as well as the ruby slippers, like we are on the Andrew Lloyd Webber reality TV show, and basically says, bye, Dorothy, clicking her heels to send Dorothy home before she can really say goodbye. Belina is bougie now, and she stays behind, a bright life engulfing her, and then clouds, and then a twig in muddy water, a meadowlark, a Judy Garland-like muttering, stranded back on the banks of the Kansas River, not far from the sanitarium. Dorothy hears familiar barks, and then Toto, Uncle Henry, running. His leg is mended. It's mended. And then Aunt Em with a blanket and a farmhand search party scooping up Dorothy in immense relief. Dorothy 2, natural disasters 0, and taking her back home as Dorothy learns Dr. Joanne Worley went down in the fire the electrical storm caused, and Dorothy watches a nurse Mombi be carted away by police, a similar imprisoned fate as her Oz witch counterpart. But then we are back on the farm, bathed in hope, just about finished and less cluttered than before, witnessing Dorothy in her new room, her first bedroom, catch her first glimpse of Ozma Mirror TV, which she decides to not show Aunt Em, and then barrels down the stairs to go play with Toto, a carefree little girl again, back on her farm, back home.
It is mended. I thought of that.
Cassine, that was that line. Like, we couldn't stop laughing over that line. That's in scene one. It really got us where she's like, Uncle Henry, when Aunt Em is talking about Uncle Henry's, like, she's like, it is mended. It is mended.
There are a lot of, especially in the first like 10 minutes of the film, I felt like there were like a number of really bizarre lines, just like that was just like landed like a bowling ball. Like, I was, what's happening? Yes. Like, it was so weird.
Jarring.
You're right. We've talked about this, that we were saying, like, I think if it just owned that it's campy,
yeah,
it would,
you would have had a different film. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. The so, like, all of that stuff. Doesn't quite land. Oh. And like, or the like, you want to go for a ride, Dorothy?
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't quite land. It's like, creepy. Oh. Yeah, you're not like, yes! Like, I feel like, well, actually now I feel like we would go to theaters and be like, yes, we want to go for a ride.
There should be like a Rocky Horror reinterpretation.
Well, it's funny because the tone of the film catches up to the beginning, but like in the beginning, because you're grounded in Kansas,
you
don't know what's going on. You know, it took a while to like sort of orient myself to the speed of the movie as an adult.
Right.
Yeah.
100%. It does ask, that's the thing, this film asks a lot of us, like, yes, as right, audience
you can't
members.
Check out. Yeah.
You cannot check out. You have to kind of deal with your own Oz interpretations and like where Oz sits in your life. Like, if the Judy Garland film is all you know and love, this is whack. This is beyond.
But it rewards
whack.
You though. And that's what I have to say. It's really fair. Because I think about like Moulin Rouge. This is like a weird tangent, but like Baz Luhrmann always said, Baz Luhrmann said like the first 15 minutes of Moulin Rouge is so manic because he sort of wanted to weed out people that like wouldn't be able to go for the ride of the film. Like, he wanted you to turn it off if you weren't going to be able to handle the whole film. And so I feel like this film, if you stay with it, it really does reward you. But I could easily see someone being like, what in the world, after like the first 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
100.
Oh, that's smart.
And this is something we've talked about off mic, Em and I, that I think what you feel in this film is Walter Murch, the director, who this is like all of his vision. You feel his anxiety in this film a little bit because he really wasn't supported by Disney, which is my theory to why Disney also may not want to really own this property, because they can. It's a cult classic now at this point. Mm-hmm. They can do a resurgence of it. They can have a big 40th anniversary in a couple years. But I don't know if they will, because they know that I think they're responsible for what was a little bit bumpy on this journey. And the fact that he wasn't supported, you know, they were like pressuring him to go faster and he needed more time, and had to make budget cuts like on the daily. And it was his first director helm. Like, that's a lot on one person. And he came back after being fired. Like, there's just so much that you feel his anxiety in this film. Like, the choppiness of the splicing of the scene sometimes, like the cloud moment. Like, that is so weird to me, to go from white light to clouds to weird riverbank. It just feels like, oh, okay, here we are. You just feel like that. Come on, like someone's saying you need to be done.
Wrap it up.
Film.
Wrap it up.
Yeah, you need to be done.
We're over budget.
I know we need to get to your bullet points, but I just want to presence that. Like, you just feel, and I think that's maybe the disservice of this film, that if I wonder if it was really supported, what we would have gotten. Because, y'all, that script is not the same that they had for, like, the last script to what we get. It's, like, so much got cut. Like, it's just crazy. It wouldn't have been the same picture.
You know what? There was so much, like low to mid-grade live-action Disney films in the late 70s to early, you know, to mid-80s, where this,
Escape from
to
Witch
me,
Mountain,
felt...
Yes.
This feels to me more like a bigger budget version of that than it does like an Oz film, you know, with what that should mean in terms of budget and proper in not property, but support, you know?
Yes. It feels like Escape from Witch Mountain Disney with Dark Crystal creators.
Right.
Like that's what it feels like. It's like, oh, they have these really new innovative people, but they didn't really want to shift completely to them. Mm-hmm. Which it makes sense. Like, I think we have to remember like transitioning for anything is hard, and Disney is in a transition in this moment. Big, and it just wasn't really knowing. Yeah, it wasn't really knowing how they wanted to move forward.
But I'm
still grateful the film exists.
I have to say, and this might be jumping the gun a little bit, but it's funny to me when you think about the 1939 film, you know, like how old that film is and how amazing it looks in terms of like the creature design, the effects work. Like it, like that film you could still put up against any film today in terms of just the aesthetic, like just watch it on mute, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's so interesting how, whether we're talking The Wiz, Return to Oz, any of the other Oz like film adaptations, like just from an aesthetic quality, I feel like no Oz film has ever been able to sort of match that 39 film, even with all of the advances in technology and effects. And it's such a, it is an appreciated aspect. I think people do recognize it about that original film, but it's so stunning to just sort of really juxtapose these moments like the Emerald City goodbye. It's a different goodbye. It's a different Emerald, but it's, you know, you could just look at those two sequences and go like, they don't even really compare aesthetically, I think. But
no.
That's, you know, again, I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but that's, you know, one of the things when we're talking about budget and support and all those sorts of things, it's amazing that where did the time go, you know, in terms of advancement.
Fun fact, the Guinness Book of World Records is, I don't think we've ever said this, this used to be listed as the biggest gap in sequels.
What? Oh, wow.
But then Bambi took it away.
The Bambi
sequel that happened in 2006 with Bambi 2.
Don't
took
talk
it
about
away.
It.
Electric Boogaloo.
Which is funny because it's like, it's not really a sequel. That's like a whole thing that we've discussed too. It's not really a sequel, but it is a sequel at the same time.
Terror, can I, one thing that I was like, oh, I wonder what Terror would think. And I'm surprised. I actually understand this being a sequel. I can kind of get behind it because I feel like in the beginning of our journey, we were very much like, we're not really here for it. Even though I know you as a kid. Yeah. Even I know you as a kid, you were like, I accept it. I think I get it now, because I at first was like, absolutely not. In what world is this a sequel? And now when you bring the books into it, I can understand. So I just wanted to say that I've grown.
It's a sequel in an alternate Oz universe.
I could see that.
See, I think it's a pretty, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you. I think it's a sequel. And I say that.
She ages though, friends. She
let me
ages.
Give you, can I, okay, wait, hold on. Let me pull out some receipts for you. Hold on, wait, here we go.
Yeah,
so here we go. So number one, I think the fact that we have the ruby slippers back, I think that's a big, like, that's 80% of my argument. But I think also the moment when you had the Gnome King kind of have that, like, so that good stinger of, like, there is no place like home. You know, that, like, you know, like that moment, I was like, they're leaning into it. Like, they're just doing
it. Layering it on.
Yeah. And I think that makes it, you can make an argument that it's not a sequel, but I almost think any argument that you would make is more of a like tonal argument, maybe an aesthetic argument. I don't think it's that aesthetic. Like when you look at the data that you have been presented in terms of the script, yes, the book, right. I think it's a sequel through and through.
I think I'm with you. Oh my gosh. I never thought I would say
that. Doesn't mean it's a good sequel. Right. You know, just
that it fully makes sense. Cause yeah, there is the de-aging. But yes, when you look at the script, it's like, oh, okay.
Do you know who the only two actors who were alive from MGM, besides Munchkin actors from the principal cast? Do you know who they were?
Ooh.
For when this film was released? From principal cast for MGM when this movie was released. A little trivia.
Margaret Hamilton.
Just passed.
Oh, man.
Not Margaret.
I'm going to say, I almost want to say, I don't know why I feel this way, but I want to say like Roy Bolger.
That's what I would say.
I felt
the other one's deep. Deep cut, but he's considered principal cast. Deep cut.
Jerry Mayer.
Did you say
A lot of the Munchkins were alive.
If you say Uncle Henry, I will log off right now.
I was gonna say, don't say it.
Don't do it. Okay.
No. I will log off.
Frank Morgan and Charlie Grapewin and I think Clara Blandick, who were our oldest actors, I think, on the film, all passed. I think.
Oh, is it the Winky guard?
No, the head. But you're getting closer. Nico.
No, that was going to be my next. I swear. No, I promise that was going to be my next guest. I promise that was. I swear to you.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, Margaret passed in May 1985. This movie came out in June.
Oh, that is too bad.
She
wow.
totes yeah, would have been at all the things because she's just like Oz ally for life. Like, talk
that's
about
too
that
bad. Woman. Wow, that's a shame.
Yeah.
I think she would have liked it, actually.
I think she would have loved, mm-hmm. like, being in interviews, being like, oh, I think you should see it. Like, she she's lovely, that Margaret
love
Hamilton.
Love that Margaret, yeah. For
okay,
sure.
Get back to your bullet points.
Getting back to the bullet.
I off-road at you.
Okay.
Who wants to go? Do you want to go or do you want
to go? Cassine, take it away.
Okay, all right. I kept mine kind of concise, but I hope I did this. I hope I did this right. Okay, so, Deja Vu. For the first time, Dorothy, back in her MGM footwear, says goodbye, Yellow Brick Road,
again
to new and old friends. Modernity sucks. Never go back to save the machines. New house, new mirror, new queen, new character design for old characters. Oh my. Belina's got the right idea. Why didn't we all just stay in Oz? That's it.
I'm not going back to that
gorgeous
humdrum life.
I'm not going back.
She's so put upon too. She's like so like offended by the idea.
Yeah, I actually love the Belina switch so much. Also, that was an excellent bullet point. And I love the Belina switch because she's the whole movie. She's like, we're so far from Kansas.
I know.
And then she's finally like, I'm staying.
But she does say goodbye to the chickens, though. She does want to, you know.
Give my love.
In the script, it very distinctly says in the script, when Dorothy runs outside in that final moment, she runs out into the chickens, but there is no Belina.
Oh,
you can tell.
It says that.
There's
you at the crossroads. What a shame.
So Belina got taken in the electrical storm, I guess.
I know. No one mentions her. Sad. See, yes, that's the other thing. Where's Belina? Too.
Yeah.
Right. It says in the script, like, she's not there, which none of us would know from the film, like, to even think about it. But, of course. All right, Em, take
us home.
That was
a great bullet point. I try. Mine was a little bit more run-on this time. Okay.
It's okay.
Okay.
We support you.
Thank you so much. Fresh off their tour of destruction of the Gnome King's palace, Dorothy and friends find themselves in a field uncertain of where TikTok went. Aha! One last ornament is hanging from the gump's antler, and TikTok returns with the symbol Oz. A procession in the Emerald City ensues, with book characters and references scattered as far as the eye can see, apparently. Dorothy riding the lion and waving to an adoring crowd, who then hiss and boo at the still-imprisoned Mombi.
It's so good! Shame. Shame!
I know.
It's so good.
It's so
intense. It's like the Game of Thrones walk.
Yeah, yeah. Or I thought of, like, the Princess Bride when she's like, boo. Yeah. Dorothy yes, it's a terrifying moment. Dorothy rescues Ozma from the mirror, and Ozma is set back on her rightful throne, ruby slippers and all. A tearful goodbye follows, with Dorothy waking up in the muck and mire of Kansas, Aunt Em, Marie, and Toto all reuniting, and my heart bursts at the seams. Come to find out, the sanitarium burned to the ground, Dr. Worley along with it, and Dorothy exchanges a meaningful stare with Nurse Wilson Mombi. Rolling by in a horse and buggy. Back on the Kansas farm, Dorothy enjoys her new room, summons Ozma in the mirror, where they exchange a secret knowing smile. And Toto and Dorothy play on the farm as the end credits and gorgeous music play.
And then Disney Plus suggests to you that you should watch Chronicles of Narnia next.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Ignore. I want to see these credits.
I want to see the credits. And I'm glad I hung in there because I love that at the very end it goes to
that CPS.
The old timey portrait.
Yeah.
Love it.
It's really
I was
cool.
curious how long it was going to play out too. I was like, how much are we going to get of this footage of like just playing with Toto in the
Ignore Narnia.
But in all seriousness, I know I'm jumping, but like the house actually looked pretty good. At the end.
It looks
I was like,
great.
Look at you.
Good shape.
That's nice.
Good shape.
Time has passed.
Yeah. It's because it's mandate. It is mandate.
A lot of shiplap, man. That thing would go for a lot now. That's an HGTV.
I would buy it.
Yeah. It's because Uncle Henry took some happy pills. Like he was like, "Hi, Dorothy." Like I know. That morning. Like he's been working hard.
He Even Aunt Em was like person. More pleasant, right? Like she was like kind of.
They
nice.
Both were just like, "Yeah." Lots of smiles. The Wizard of Oz is a timeless story. Our favorite timeless story, duh, that can be told through every artistic medium under the rainbow.
And that includes Rising Star Makeup Artists' flagship and limited edition Emerald City collection that has put the Wash and Brush Up Company out of business, honey.
From stunning eyeshadows, glowing highlighters, to eye-catching lip care, each product is carefully formulated and packaged to enhance and inspire creativity. All Rising Star MUA products are also vegan and cruelty-free, celebrating an inclusive and conscious community of dream chasers of all ages, backgrounds, and gender expressions. We love to see it.
The Emerald City Collection is a must for any Ozbounder, cosplayer, or fan, beauty and cosmetics lover, or anyone in search of aesthetic magic they can bring to their everyday. Personally, the LTB Oh My lip gloss is a daily go-to and new favorite.
Visit Rising Star MUA at risingstarmua.com, linked in our show notes, for the merry old glow-up you've been waiting for. Here's to our fierce faces looking yes. glam down our yellow brick road.
I'm going to talk about this more when we have our like recap, like post-production episode, but I have been reading now, nerds, this is, I'm here.
Okay, I'm She's here. Arrived.
I've been reading, I found when I went home, my little novella Del Rey copy of Return to Oz, which is a novelized version of the screenplay, but it's the screenplay of that script that didn't fully get seen.
Oh, that's
so it has all those moments. And the development of Aunt Em, I keep voice memoing Em as like, Aunt Em is so developed in this because we find out that her father was a minister. And she, this is like the first time that faith hasn't worked out for her. Like she's really in like going through it, like having personal dilemma because like God isn't helping her get this farm back together. Dorothy is really in this really rough position with like, they think she's disturbed, all of that happening. And she is questioning if God exists. Isn't that
That's a
wild?
Big
In
thing,
fairness, yeah. in 1899, everyone's father was a minister. Every single person. Can I ask you, this is like a super nerdy question, but who wrote it? I want to know who wrote the novelization.
I will tell you her bio because I also want to look her up and see
yeah,
if she's
I'm
still
curious.
With us and maybe get her on the pod because it's really great. Yes. She is also kind of famous. So here we go. And this is her 1985 bio. Joan DeVinge, one of the most popular movie novelizers today, is an SF author. Cassine, what does that mean?
SF. I don't know.
Like,
that was my first thought would be San Francisco. And they have
science fiction.
That makes sense.
San Francisco. In her own right, her novel The Snow Queen was awarded the Hugo. Her storybook for Return of the Jedi was on the New York Times bestseller list for months. So
nice.
She did that
novelization.
She lives in the suburb of New York City with her husband, James Frankel. We're going to look him up. Publisher of Blue Jay Books and their daughter. Who's probably RHM or like a little bit older.
Probably. Still alive. Her Wikipedia. She's 74.
Okay, we're
going to
look for her. Joan, this book is amazing. It's really beautifully fleshed out.
That's a real skill. Honestly, writing novelizations is a real
skill.
It's a real skill. And those things, you know, this is like inside baseball a little bit, but they always want those things written. Like I guarantee you she had probably no exaggeration, probably like a month to write that book.
It's really well done.
So, and the people that do that, it's a real, you have to get her on. You have to try and get her on. Seriously.
You got to get her on.
Sounds amazing.
She did a great job with this. And I wonder if anyone has ever asked her a single question about Return to Oz novelization, because it is really, I'm sure the Bombugled has in the past. I'm sure they have, because they love this stuff too, but it's so good. But I really appreciate that, because it really allows us to see, like, also Aunt Em probably is restoring her faith in this last final scene that we're in. Mm. Okay, friends, why don't we go through some history before we go into the scene proper and the whole I Spy Emerald City shenanigans? I can't wait. Okay, friends. So this scene, we switch from book proper, Ozma of Oz plot. So the Gnome King was heavily the Ozma of Oz plot, back into marvelous Land of Oz lore. So we have a drastic switch for this final scene where we get the truth revealed about Ozma. And all of this, of course, happens a little bit differently. There is a very big gaping hole absence for Glinda, I think, in this film, because Glinda is the one to reveal the whole thing about Zombie Mombi. I'm just going to keep calling her that because I like it. Zombie Mombi. What a good Halloween costume. Like your Princess Mombi, but a zombie.
That's what we're doing.
That's a good one. In a cage. Yes. Loving it. Glinda reveals to Tip's true identity. So that happens in the book. And also in the book, it's not TikTok who is still an ornament. It's the Tin Woodman who's still an ornament. Mm. And they think, like, the Scarecrow's really going through it in the book because it's basically like he's lost the Bert to his Ernie. Like, he's
it's his boy.
Like, we left the Tin Man. This is terrible. But of course, they have a similar but different. I believe it's one of the children of the royal family of Ev in the book who's holding like a silly green pig ornament. That is like, it's a toy for me. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's probably the
tin. That's it.
And that's when it zaps on back. So just to presence the books that they did at least have a launching pad from the book. They just interpret it in a different way or made it their own, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. Some things just to share about this scene that you can find on IMDb. You could find on the Oz Wiki, which is great. The big thing that happened during the filming of this sequence, when Dorothy is riding on top of the Cowardly Lion, is that apparently Fruza Balk, the actress playing Dorothy, was having some issues with the temperature, because notorious to all Oz filming is like really hot temperatures on set because there's so many lights being used, usually in Emerald City sequences. This is true in the MGM film. There's some truth to this even in the Wiz film with the first time we see Richard Pryor's head, just hot lights being used. I think it got to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It's reported she passed out on the soundstage. So like having a child actor pass out, not good. That's not good protection for that child. Someone not catching that ahead of time. But just goes to show, like, because movie pressure and scheduling could just be so intense, like those things, sometimes you try to sneak around them. You don't think they're going to happen, but we have to remember we're not machines. We are humans. So she did pass out while riding, I guess, during that ride with the Cowardly Lion, which is just interesting to note. Also wanted to share this because I don't think we did before. This is a little bit of the scene prior. They were considering having the Gnome King cut the ruby slippers up to make into a magical ruby belt, which would have taken the book, the magic belt that he wears, as opposed to the ruby slippers, it would have combined those two ideas, which I would have loved to have seen, like maybe a cut scene of him being like, look what I did with your shoes.
Project Runway.
Like, just so great. Like, look at me upcycling Dorothy. Yes. Like, I really love that. But I also love that they just let him wear the shoes, because that's also excellent. So just presencing that. And also, just a few more things. Let's talk about these actors who played the Scarecrow, the Tin Woodman, and the Cowardly Lion, since we have not mentioned them yet. Okay, so first we have Justin Case as the Scarecrow, which, friends, I could not find a lot on. He's a UK actor, from what I gather. He is in the Remembering Return to Oz documentary for like a tiny, tiny moment. But he, other than that, he is a mystery to me. I wonder if he had like a film career for a short period of time and then perhaps moved on with his life in different directions that, you know, are not reported online. You know, he right. had a life, obviously. But he's a little bit of a mystery for me. Does anyone know anything more about Justin Case, who plays the Scarecrow?
I don't, but I love his name. Justin Case.
Justin Case.
That's the best name.
There's also a film called Justin Case. Like, there's a film called that. God. Like, Justin Case. So I was actually getting that when I was searching. I was like, no, it's like he's an actor. I couldn't find anything.
So absent knowing anything, I can sort of speculate a little bit, like an educated speculation, I guess is what I'd call it. I know at that time, a lot of the performers that they used inside of body puppets. So this is like really, nerdy, but go with me for a second here. This is like my film. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference between like a costume and a body puppet. And the big thing is that a costume is something that conforms to the form of the person who is wearing it. Like, your clothes conform to your body. Whereas a body puppet retains its form always. You just sort of slip into it. So like Big Bird is a puppet. Big Bird is not a costume. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yes.
So the actors that they would get inside of these body puppets oftentimes wouldn't even necessarily be actors. Sometimes they would just be like a mime or like a ballerina or someone that they just needed to do the physical demands of that particular role. So our good friend Justin Case maybe was not even pursuing a career in acting. Wow. Might have just been someone who was picked up because he had, you know, a particular height.
Unique and body abilities.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah. No, that totally makes sense, because this is like a whole other world of performers, and performers who are often not recognizable because their face is behind another face.
Right.
So it's a really fascinating world. So just in case, we see you. Thank you for your work as the Scarecrow, which we have mentioned in the past. They really wanted to do more with the Scarecrow's animation of his face, but because of budget cuts, they, I think, had a couple facial expressions that they just altered between, like frozen facial expressions that they did, as opposed to having him be a little bit more like the Gump was what they wanted him to be a little bit more like.
Can I ask a question?
Very animated. Yeah.
This is like, and you might have covered this before because now we're at the end of the road here. But what are your thoughts, your feelings on the facial expressions, like overall? Like, I was a little bit bothered initially that like the faces weren't more emotive, but then I don't know. I felt like this movie had like a weird like hex over me because there were all these things that sort of irked me. And then like I just grew to really appreciate them by the end of the movie. I felt like I was looking at like the storybook illustrations. Like, I kind of appreciated the flatness of the faces in a weird way. So I was just curious about what your thoughts were.
I think I'm with you.
I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah, with you, completely with you. I think I can see that, like, some of it being done out of necessity to the film, just keeping it moving. But I actually appreciate that we get like a Denslow illustrated Scarecrow, and a Denslow illustrated Cowardly Lion and Tin Man. Like, I appreciate that. So I'm fine with it. I am fine with it.
I think it's charming, but I could see how people who maybe don't appreciate the books as much or haven't read them or don't know that they're books could be like, this is creepy. Like, they're not very emotive. But right. I think they're emotive.
But like the MGM are kind of creepy if you look at
they're,
them.
They're right. That's interesting too. Mm-hmm.
That's a hot take. Like, that's a sizzling hot take.
If you really look at them, like, also, like, when you, if you look at
you're
them,
saying
like,
that about your boyfriend, Jack Hayes?
I am. My boyfriend.
Who are you? Jack.
No, but like if you watch like or look at, there's not anything you can watch, but you could look at some photos of them like getting the makeup on. It's like, ugh. It's just so grotesque.
I mean, it's very theatrical.
I want you to name names. Who do you think has the creepiest the creepiest character design from the MGM film?
Ooh.
I want you to pledge your allegiance to this opinion.
I think because it was real lion fur.
Ooh.
Cowardly Lion. Ooh. I think he was dying in there. Like, he was toasty.
I don't know how he got through it.
He must have smelled rank. Ooh. Like, You know what I mean? Like, I think about that often because I'm like, I smell after like doing yoga on my porch for 10 minutes. Like,
yeah. Right.
They were under hot lights. It had to be.
What was like a 130 pound suit? I mean, it was like notoriously yeah. like.
And a lion.
Yeah. And it was real lion's fur was used on it. So I think that costume for me is like, it's like, I don't like looking at it outside of like him being.
I know
in
it's weird.
Too.
It is it's weird to look see. At. I feel like it must have been very uncomfortable for Ray Bolger to have like the
Ray's
was it like
too.
Burlap,
mm-hmm.
like face. And it left
burlap
in,
face.
I love that. I think that is such brilliant. That's
it's
like
so
a it's a brilliant design.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
But as an actor to then have like lines on your face for months afterward, that's pretty yeah. intense. You know,
yeah, they all have like
an MGM. He already he had probably already filmed like four more films. You know, Louis right. Bizarre was there cracking the whip. You know,
yeah, Ray Bolger get, was off, back to get work. Up there. Get up there.
Oh my gosh. I think Ray was one of the ones who's like, I'm done with this, right? Like Ray was like, peace. I'm back to Broadway.
Back to Broadway.
He's like back
bye,
to Broadway.
Bye, Hollywood.
Bye, Hollywood.
Eight yeah, nights a week is easier than this. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he thought so. That's what's really interesting about Ray is that he did not love figuring out shots for his dancing. Mm-hmm. He liked to take up a stage.
The live,
space.
Yeah.
Yeah. He like he missed that for the
He's
for
a Broadway
it.
Performer.
Well, I wonder if Justin Case got to meet Ray Bolger at all.
I can't
fellow
get over
scarecrows.
There.
Well, then we have Deep Roy as yes. the Tin Woodman, which, Cassine, you know a lot about Deep Roy. Do you want to share about this, like, Tim Burton go-to actor, which is very exciting?
Deep Roy is an amazing performer who, actually, you can see Deep Roy in the 80s in The Neverending Story. He is like the guy everything. Who's on the snail. So he is a great, great performer, and he still is still a working actor. And he plays Roy. Every Oompa Loompa in Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Don't come at me, internet. Sorry, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I'm good. And but also he is one of the he like has a lot of like parts in the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes film as well. So Deep Roy is one of those actors that if you look him up right now, you've it's seen so his face before. Like, you know who he is. Yeah. And it's great that yeah. he is completely opaque in this costume. We have no right. idea that it's him besides looking at the credits. But great.
He almost
great
had a line. He almost Did had he? One line. It got cut. He was supposed to be the first one to say Queen of Oz. But it got cut. You could actually watch it. You could watch the deleted scene on YouTube. But he was the first one to say it, which is interesting to why they cut that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But yes, I was like, oh my gosh, this man played every, I think there was 165 Oompa Loompas. He played all
Holy
of them.
Cow.
And he took Pilates and dance lessons to prepare for the four musical numbers that he did. And that was
yes!
amazing. But the coolest thing that I was like, whoa, he has like a lot of like, he's the only one to hold this. Like he has a lot of that. Him and, or he's not the only one, him and Simon Pegg are the only holders of a unique science fiction trifecta, namely to appear in the Doctor Who, Star Wars, and Star Trek series.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that so cool? So That's he's like a, cool. like a nerd dream. Like his career is a nerd dream. Like he's been affiliated with so many like of the most iconic properties.
Wow.
Yeah, he did a lot of costume work, it says, and size double for Yoda in The Empire Strikes Back, Droopy McCool in Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi, and also, I hope I'm saying this right because I'm not a Trekkie, Kienzer or Kenzer in Star Trek?
Either.
I'm not a Trekkie. I'm so sorry,
not,
my Trekkies.
I'm not your audience.
Also in Star Trek Into Darkness, which was 2013. So like Cassine says, this man is still actively just going at it.
And can
so
I
Deep
tell
Roy
you,
was I'm the
gonna,
coolest.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to be at an event with Deep Roy at the end of October. Hello. And I'm going to try and meet him. That if I do, I'll have to like send you guys an email and let you know.
Oh my gosh. Tell him we love his work. We love
we
your
love
work,
your
Deep
work.
Roy. Oh my gosh. Well, so we also cool. have John Alexander, who played the Cowardly Lion, and he's also one of the Wheelers. So he's one of our double cast performers in this, and he has a pretty cool, his IMBD is pretty awesome. He's Scottish. He has ballet school training. He was a circus performer. He actually was in Barnum on the West End for a while. That's like where he started to make his transition more into film. Yes, he's one of the manic Wheelers. I love that. I love the Wheelers being described as manic. This is in his IMBD, and he's the gorilla digit in Warner Brothers' Gorillas in the Mist. So in addition to playing several more gorilla roles in such movies as Baby's Day Out, that's amazing, Congo, Mighty that's Joe Baby Young, Fierce Creatures, and Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, Alexander has played a variety of diverse roles, including the alien Mikey in Men in Black. Like, this is nuts, guys. Will Smith's nemesis Zara in Men in Black 2, and one of the Who's in Whoville in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, a country bear in Disney's The Country Bears, a robot in Zathura, I hope I'm saying that right, and most recently, the disembodied character of Joanne Cross and the Beth Mora Goblin in Hellboy 2. I don't know this. The Golden Army. I hope someone is a huge fan of that. And it says here that he's also acted as a consultant, choreographer, and puppeteer in many special effects extravaganzas. To date, Alexander has one of the most interesting resumes in Hollywood. He's owning it, boasting such skills as acting, dance, acrobatics, prosthetic and mask work, puppeteering, creature movement, fight arrangement, horse riding, and last but not least, unicycle.
That's a skill.
This is a wild resume. Whoa.
He's a circus guy. Like, there it is. Like, you know what I mean? He's like, he can do a lot. Circus cool. people, I think, are the most amazing people because they know their body, and oh my gosh, they could do so much with their body. They, I think, are also always up to learn a new skill because they have proven to themselves they could do anything. Because if you can do flips and tricks, you can do anything.
Yeah. Wow.
Right? So I was like, look at these.
Now I've got like just like that.
Which is kind of like the music in this, like this last rag march that we get from beautiful David Shire's score. Like, it has a circus element to it. It totally feels like we're at like the 1900 World's Fair in Paris. That's like what I feel when we come to the Emerald City.
It doesn't even feel like it's a part of this film. It feels completely like divorced from the rest of the film, I feel like.
It does. And there's also, this is pretty cool, we've been having fun experimenting with this on Instagram of just pairing David Shire's score to the MGM and vice versa, which is a lot of fun. There's a video on YouTube of this scene paired to the cut song, the reprise of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, that did not happen in the MGM film, with all the Emerald City citizens rejoicing and welcoming back Dorothy with the broomstick and all of our friends. There's a beautiful recording of it that you can hear on the extended album, and that's what they use to pair with this scene. It actually fits perfectly, which is like a little bit like chill-inducing. You're like, oh my God, it's like it knew. And there also is, as we'll get more into the Easter eggs, on a staircase when they're right before they go into that shot that pans over the mirror, there is a full-on marching band that has like all the like the ornate flowers. I was like, they have to be giving a nod to MGM here. That's like what that MGM scene was. It was like flowers and marching bands. I was like, that has to be a nod to that because it's pretty cool. So you can watch that on YouTube, which is neat, just seeing the MGM cut song paired to this scene.
That's cool.
In particular.
Do you have any sense of when this film, this sequence was shot in relation to the rest of the film?
It's hard to find that information on this film. Like,
I was really curious about it.
That's really hard to find out. We were so on that with The Wizard of Oz MGM. And with The Wiz, I think we were able to piece together this one. That is all a mystery to me. Like, when they shot certain scenes, no clue. It feels.
I feel like it had to be like the very beginning or the very end. Like, it just, it feels out of sync, like in terms of just the tone of the whole film.
Ooh, interesting.
I would say, maybe the end.
I think end, because Firuza looks a little aged at the end.
She looks a little bit older,
Yes. Yes. Also, did y'all know Emma Ridley did audition for Dorothy? Did you know that? Who plays
Ozma? Really? Oh,
she did audition for Dorothy. That was like her in to like, you know, coming into the film, but then they kept her for Ozma instead, which is fun.
Didn't know that.
Also, I found a few more people who were potentially in the running for Dorothy. One of them being, I'm so excited. I'm so scared.
Really? A little Elizabeth Berkeley? Is that nice. You.
But she would have been older. Like, I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, she would have been like a little bit older, right? She had to be like at least, well, I guess no, 1985. Because Saved by the Bell, she's a teenager That's Saved by the Bell, Em. I know I'm dating you.
I don't know. I'm like,
Wait, are you not a Saved by the Bell? Are you not a Saved by the Bell?
She's too young.
I'm too young.
How old are you? Can I ask?
I'm 30.
She's too
young. Oh my goodness.
I was born 92.
It was my generation is the young generation of Saved by the Bell because we got the repeats. My generation, which is I'm age 35.
I'm 36.
Amazing. Yeah. So yeah, we got
every now and then with 5 years, that's not a big gap, but there's little things where it's like, oh, I just missed it.
Honestly can't believe that I can't imagine growing up in a world without Saved by the Bell. It's that much of the DNA of my childhood. Yes. I can't even.
Same. It's so DNA for me too. Cause I watched it on TBS in the mornings, but this is also, I will say this in reverse, Hannah Montana. No.
Nothing. You know what I mean? It means nothing.
Oh, to me. I watched a lot of Hannah Montana.
It means nothing to me. I've never seen a single episode.
That was a big
part of my childhood. Saved by the Bell is a big divide. And I think Lizzie McGuire, Hannah Montana, because that's where I just was a little too old.
That is my everything.
But me and you are close in age, and my 33-year-old friends, they'll be big Lizzie McGuire fans, and I'll be I didn't watch that. I was just a little too old.
We're going to give some free promo, but if you aren't listening to it's discontinued, but the Zach to the
You told us
podcast.
About this did last
I,
time.
Did I tell you this already? Are you kidding? I can't believe this has come up twice. Oh my
Ambassador.
Gosh. It's I'm shilling for this podcast now.
Yeah.
You have to, but if you haven't listened, you have to go listen to it. I won't do the whole commercial again, but it's great.
It's a great podcast. I listened to it.
Cool.
It's Zach Morris. What is his name? Mark Patrick.
Mark Paul Gosselaar. Yeah.
Mark Paul Patrick. Yes, he revisits Saved by the Bell for the first time because he never watched it for lots of really interesting reasons to why he wouldn't watch it.
So he's basically I mean, they both have never watched Saved by the Bell. I mean, it's
never watched it with him. I've never seen an episode.
Unbelievable to me.
Wow. We'll watch him. We'll watch. It's Saved by the Bell is classic. It's so good. But anyways, Elizabeth Berkley would have been a really interesting choice as Dorothy Gale, but she was also up for this.
But I was just going to say, I'm sure you've discussed this before, but because I wasn't here for it, can we just talk about Rooza as Dorothy Rooza. And like her, dislike, Rooza.
What are your thoughts?
Love. Strong love.
I think she's amazing.
I think she's perfect.
I could not believe how much I liked her.
I really
in the beginning, I was like, okay, we're going dark. And part of this is informed by knowing her as a teenage and an adult actor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay, this is who's playing Dorothy? Great. And I knew it, but I was like, okay, I'm going to strap in and watch this now for 2 hours again as an adult. But it was, and there were slight moments, just tinges of Judy Garland once she got better, but just a little,
you're on with us.
Just a sprinkling. And I was man, this is such a good performance.
Agreed.
Really, really, really good.
She channeled something.
You basically summed up everything we've said.
Yeah.
Into one nice, succinct,
you're
review
on, you're
of
on top of it.
Performance. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I was going to add was that I don't know who this person is, so please come to me if you know who she is. I did not look her up. But Toni Ann Gisondi was also up for this role.
Oh, my God. She played Molly.
Oh my God. So Toni Ann Gisondi is iconic as Molly.
Oh my God.
She's iconic as Molly in the 1982 Annie. Oh my God. Yes. Also want to say this now, the first shot we get of Emerald City with it's almost like a Disney electrical parade that we get of it. But it also reminds me of the end of the Annie movie where they're all dressed up. All the orphans come to Daddy Warbucks' mansion. It's everyone has 80s hairstyles, but it's totally Victorian era. It totally is the same bougie vibe, that classy, almost I think of a Mother in Ragtime too. These are all pop culture references that I'm just throwing in because that's my way to describe these things. But I really had a flashback to that last scene in the Annie movie at the top of this, which is interesting to note.
Can I tell you something? Toni played Molly and has a daughter in real life named Molly.
That's cute.
That's really cute.
Also a whole really web page called annieorphans.com where you can look up everyone who who's played it.
There's a really great doc on the kids.
That's a bit much. The database is that's a touch much.
Who did this?
You know, that's not for me. That's
you
not
can
for
use
me.
The internet for good and the internet for evil. That's a touch much.
It's like you have a little too much time on your hands.
Yep.
But like pretty wow. excellent. That
but I also am going to stalk it. So.
Where is Pepper from the 1985?
It's on
here. You can find out.
Thank you so much for listening to part one of this episode. Please stay tuned for part two dropping this Wednesday.
Thank you so much for listening to Down the Yellow Brick Pod. If you are feeling fresh with your fingertips, scroll on over to Apple Podcasts and now Spotify, woot woot, to leave us a glowing rate and review. It's a big help.
Each person who leaves us an Apple review will be entered to win our end of the season Oz giveaway, including a gift basket of Aussie book goodies that, trust me, you aren't going to want to miss.
All previous reviews will also be considered in our entries. We see you.
Further fun and ways to support us can be found at our Etsy swag shop, from Good Witch Trouble merch to our new Fab Four of Oz icon collection, with a big shout out to our graphic designer, Maddie Frank. Find us also on Patreon and Instagram via Down the Yellow Brick Pod, as well as on Venmo at Down the YBP. We always appreciate a tip to you.
Let's escape to Oz soon, okay?
Okay, Auntie Anne.